And as you find your seat again for the perhaps the second time tonight, just notice how the body feels maybe after a little bit of sugar or caffeine from a tea or cookies. So I don't know if you all are familiar with the three types of personalities, broadly speaking, in Buddhist psychology. There's the greed type, the aversive type, and the delusional type. This is evidence that I am a greed type. So this is ambitious. We might not get through all this, but we'll see. I appreciate what Jack Kornfield often says. If you missed it or you didn't hear it, don't worry, you already know it. So just enjoy and see what lands, let go of what doesn't. So I wanted to open with a quote from John O'Donohue, a beautiful Irish mystic whom I love, who has since passed over, but he wrote, "I would love to live like a river flows, carried by the surprise of its own unfolding." And to me, this seems like such a beautiful encapsulation of really what is this ride of faith, but allowing ourselves to slip into the flow of the river. Faith, for many of us, it can have a charged word, charged quality to it. I was raised Catholic, very strict Catholic family. I'm the youngest of seven, church all the time. My parents were very different in their embodiment of their Catholicism. My mom was British, Church of England, and she converted. And bless her, those that convert have their own particular energy about Catholicism. My father was much more of the from God's mouth to his ear, which had its own quality. And my parents have both passed in the last 2 years. And my mom, she was an embodiment of what I'll speak of in a little bit, what Sharon Salzberg and what the Buddha taught is the qualification of bright faith, the faith that you just fall in love. And my mom's was very much lived her life, a long and beautiful life, in that quality of bright faith. And she was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer. And bless her, I was with her the day before she was going to see the doctor to get the official diagnosis. And she was talking about wanting to test drive a Mini Cooper. She was 89. And what she wanted to do with a garden. I was like, I don't know that you'll be able to drive a new car or build the garden that you want to. And she's like, I know. The Lord has called me and I'm going to heaven and it's going to be great. And she had that attitude the entirety of the 6 months in which she lived. And it was an inspiration to behold. And my father passed at 94. And his quality of his faith was different. But he too was like, in Catholicism, for those who don't know, the priest gives you last rites, sort of cleans you of all your sins. And Dad said, I'm going to heaven. And he was delighted. He kind of couldn't. He's like, when this body goes, I'm going to heaven. I'll see Barbara, and it's going to be great. And it was so inspiring that their belief was so strong that they were clear what was going to happen in their next incarnation or next form. And tonight, the making the distinction here and in the Buddhist world of what the belief is versus a faith, belief tends to be something that we cling to, that we hold on to. And we're seeing this widely in the public discourse about the quality of one's beliefs and what we believe, and we're rigid to it, and it's often can come from a place of fear. I believe this. I am right. You are wrong. I will make others wrong. Whereas faith is really about dropping in and staying open. That faith is really a dropping into and an allowing, and it's an open receptivity. And that's what I want to play with in our time together tonight. For me, as Christina alluded to, the day long on divorce, I did it once last year. And again, offering it this year because it's about a 2-year process. And really, it was one of the hardest experiences of my life. And I'm a very well-resourced person, I would say. And I could not believe how hard it was. And it was that sense of, what else is this about but for the opportunity to really dive into the practice, to try to wake up to how to turn the suffering that any of us might feel in whatever we're going through when we get the news of our child is sick or our dog is sick or our life is not working out as it planned, sometimes it's so hard, the weight is so heavy. And one of the invitations of this practice is to say, right, that's what happens in this life. That's what this realm is about. So how can we take what's happening, what's so hard and so painful, and we have that juncture where I can slip into a place of it's just me and I'm alone and I'm suffering, which I can go there. But does it help me? No. The alternative is to drop into, can I really dig into the loamy soil of the faith to say, how do I use this to find freedom and to wake up? And going back a little bit to the distinction between faith and belief from Alan Watts, he writes, we must make here a clear distinction between belief and faith, because in general practice, belief has come to mean a state of mind which is almost the opposite of faith. Belief, as he's using it, is the insistent that truth is what one would wish it to be. The believer will open his mind to truth on the condition that it fits with his preconceived ideas and wishes. Right? We see this happening. Faith, on the other hand, is the unreserved opening of the mind to truth, whatever it turns out to be. Faith has no preconceptions. It's a plunge into the unknown. Belief clings, but faith lets go. In the sense of the word, faith is the essential virtue of science and likewise of any religion that is not self-deception. Right? This beautiful plunging into the unknown and the power that can come from really embracing, okay, let's see what happens next. My daughter and I flew back from Florida yesterday, and we were watching Moana, which I've seen more times than they care to admit. And I don't know if Moana comes up much in Dharma talks, but I'll speak of it. Because I was watching this and thinking about faith and reading different books and watching this movie and really watching that this character, for those of you who haven't seen it, it's this beautiful young girl who's going to become head of her community in the island, but the island is dying. And so she gets on the boat and crosses over the reef, which was forbidden in her community, to cross over into the unknown to save herself and save the island, which of course that works out, being Disney. But this sense of, oh, this is faith, that she took the leap to cross over the reef, to journey into a way of how could she save herself, for she wanted nothing more in her life than to go out into the ocean. And how could she save her family and her community and her island? And when we think about what is the hero's journey, it's a journey of faith, right? The journey of Siddhartha, who was raised in all sorts of luxury and was primed to be king. And he steps outside of the palace gates, if you were, and saw the messengers of death and sickness and old age and thought, what? Surely there's a way to find freedom beyond the material wealth and the luxuries. So he said, see ya, to his parents, who were probably, his dad, probably was not thrilled, and stepped out to live a life as an ascetic to find a sense of true health and wealth and happiness from within. And this hero's journey plays out through literature. It's an archetype, and we all know it from our own lives. The times when we've left that nearer shore to step out to find a way of, please, tell me there's something more. When I sat my first retreat here about 20, almost exactly 20 years ago, it was an August retreat, and I was a hot mess. I was going through a lot of family of origin trauma, and no amount of therapy seemed to be really helping me, and really came and sat a retreat at the behest of some of my friends, and fell so deeply in love with the practice and to be in a field when no one was talking to me and everybody seemed so kind in the practice of metta and the generative quality of goodwill. And I sat as many retreats as I could for years. And I had the naive thought that when I get happy, I wonder if I'll still want to sit retreat. Oh, such a naive idea. But really, it was that blush of the bright faith and really just could not get enough of it. And as faith is taught in this three developments of faith, the first is this bright faith is, oh, I want that. We might meet a teacher who has these just amazing bright light qualities that we think, I want what that person has. and what can I do? Or something that we've read that really speaks to us and takes a hold and it ignites the fire, right? And that is great for a while. If we stay stuck in that, it can become a blind faith in which we don't question it. We just accept it as it is. This is how it is. But the Buddha really was all about, no, try it out. See what happens. So the next phase is that into verifying, to verify the faith. And the way that we verify it is to doubt, and not doubt in the way of like, oh, what is this? This is stupid. Or the cynical doubt that can come up. And again, we are in a culture that a cynical doubt can really pervade what's happening to us. Skillful doubt is more of, is this true? Does this work? If I sit for 10 minutes and breathe and pay attention to how my foot feels on the floor, do I feel better? Maybe. And it's this chance to really explore. And he was very much, try it out. Don't take my word for it. Don't take the word of the experts. Don't take the word of all the people that are writing. We must embrace it and practice. It is a practice. Take it, try it. This works, this doesn't. This is a good practice, this fits. I don't understand this, to question. It's a real opening up to an ability to question. And as a growing up as a Catholic, questioning was really not part of the program. This is how it is. And if you don't do it, you're going to go to hell. Well, that was not so inspiring. It was scary. But it didn't want lead one into a sense of fullness in our own goodness. And this practice is really about how do we clear away the obfuscations of what gets in the way from our luminous heart and our steady mind. And we can have faith and a belief that in our own goodness. The Pali word for faith is sadha, S-A-D-D-H-A, and it is really one of my favorite words. The literal translation is to rest the heart upon. And what do we rest the heart upon? Other ways it can be translated is the trust and confidence. Hospitality is also another form in which this is used, and I love this because it's just this, with the hospitality, it's the sense of, okay, to pull from the guest house by rooming, welcome and entertain all that come. For each has been sent as a guest from beyond to awaken us, to say, here, work with this. Explore it, investigate it, see what the roots of this particular suffering are, to be able to ideally then uproot that which is causing us suffering and step into freedom. What can get lost in a lot of the conversations with secular mindfulness is that it can be arguably a way of allowing us just to become more comfortable in our lives and more comfortable in samsara, which is helpful in a beautiful practice, and that there's more, that really these teachings are really about, no, you can be free. That the Buddha said, look, I did it, and you could do it, and I wouldn't teach it if it weren't possible. But you got to work at it. And you got to take time and be committed to it. And faith is sort of the fuel and the energy which allows us to really embrace, like, okay, I'm going to check it out and try it. I'm going to share this from David Wyatt, his poem called Faith. I want to write about faith, about the way the moon rises over cold snow night after night. Faithful even as it fades from fullness, slowly becoming the last curving and impossible sliver of light before the final darkness. But I have no faith myself. I refuse it the smallest entry. Let this then, my small poem, like a new moon slender and barely open, be the first prayer that opens me to faith. And we can embrace our faith step by step. To see it is a journey, and it starts with one step and it progresses forward, and we must allow ourselves the chance to try it and see what happens. When it, quote, a very famous philosopher, Calvin, as in Calvin and Hobbes. For those of you who don't know, it's a cartoon, and Calvin is about 6, and his best friend is his toy tiger. And when Calvin and Hobbes are together, Hobbes is alive. But the first one, Calvin's out by himself at night, and he's underneath the stars, and he looks up at the stars and shouts, I'm significant. Silence. Screamed the dust speck, he says. Right, in the sense of how do we find a way when we can are feeling in a place of loss, or we're feeling lonely or in a despairing place, that we can go, what's the point? There's a, what does this matter? What am I doing here? It's the grind of our lives of work and mortgages or rent or payments or the way that the stress can be. It's stress in the Bay Area. It's hard to live here. It can be. And we can find ourselves kind of perhaps weighted by a sense of meaninglessness of how do I really make meaning in this life? Faith. And Joseph Goldstein talks about faith in this way, that through the suffering that is a given, a way to make meaning is to dive into the understanding that can come from the suffering. Well, let's look at it. If I'm suffering from whatever it is I might be suffering from, can I just pause and take time? Well, what's actually going on? Can I cut through the story, the narrative that might be 10 years old about why this happened and who did what and then this happened? Up, up, up. Okay. To be able to cut through that, to really just sit with, well, what is the actual experience in this moment, and can I find a sense of freedom? And there can be all this talk about enlightenment and liberation and freedom as if it's a destination over here that maybe we'll get to in 20 or 30 lifetimes, which again, not so inspired, beautiful aspiration. And yet, there's a Tibetan master whose name I'm forgetting that's really about, no. Small moments. Many times in a row. It can really be about liberation in this moment. In this moment, I'm not caught. I'm not caught with fear or hatred or delusion, but I can rest in a sense of ease and openness of my heart. I can feel energetically and physically that I'm resting my heart upon something. I am embodying a sense of faith. There's a rest there. There's a chance to have a sense of freedom. And knowing that in the body there's this moment, and then we string many moments together when we can. And we don't beat ourselves up when we can't. From Paulo Coelho. Tell your heart that the fear of suffering is worse than the suffering itself, and that no heart has ever suffered when it goes in search of its dreams, because every second of the search is a second's encounter with God and with eternity. I want to do a little bit of a dive into some of the teachings of faith. Again, this notion of resting our heart. And I want to invite you as I'm talking just to consider what is it that you rest your heart upon. I want to pull a little bit more from what Joseph Goldstein shared on faith since he was just here. Not really talking about faith when he was here, but he spoke about in his, the way he holds faith is a way of slipping into a different way of relating to gravity. We can relax into a different gravitational pull of the Dharma. It becomes a new force of gravity in our lives, getting a sense of a selfless, empty center. And this becomes the awakening of faith. Again, this idea of stepping into the flow, into the release. Faith is, it sustains the energy of almost all spiritual paths. It is a way of understanding. It opens us to things greater than ourselves. Faith is our initial inspiration, and it is that which sustains us to move forward on the path. And he really talks about a sense of being able to feel into a sense of movement. Oh, I do feel better when I sit. Or I notice, oh, I feel very discombobulated when I don't sit, to notice the absence of what happens when we don't practice. Well, in that, if we do it enough, we can, that develops its own sense of momentum of, oh, this is helping me. This is of benefit in leading me into a place of less stress and greater freedom. Faith is a deepening in understanding and a deepening of wisdom that every action takes on meaning. It's not about getting something or even getting anywhere, but really about understanding. And through that understanding comes wisdom. And through our wisdom comes a sense of skillfulness and our responsiveness in the world, whether it's to our own internal world, to the world of our beloveds, or how we respond to what's happening out in the world today. When we are buoyed and anchored by a sense of wisdom and faith, we're much more able to respond in a way that's of benefit both to ourselves and to those, our fellow humans and animals, to be able to tend to the earth in a way when we're not as obscured and caught in reactivity and anger. When our life is about understanding, understanding every situation in our lives, every moment, am I awake in this moment? Can I be responsive in this moment? Am I suffering? And if I am, what's the causes of suffering? Can I settle my system down enough to investigate to see, oh, it's this habit? And can I unwind myself, untangle myself from this particular habit that's been formed over time? In this talk, Joseph also talks about the role of prayer. Again, as a Catholic, we prayed a lot. And we don't talk about prayer much here. The devotional aspect of the practice, which is alive and well, is not so much something that is stressed here, but it's here. And really, through the practices of metta and wishing well and loving kindness and may all beings be happy or free, it is a form of prayer, right? This well-wishing, this generative goodwill out in the world. The practice of devotion and gratitude is itself a prayer. And prayer becomes a way, this is from Joseph, prayer becomes a way of recognizing our own minds. Our own mind and those to whom we are praying become inseparable. Right, so nice. Our own mind and those to whom we pray become inseparable. We start by relating to someone outside of ourselves and feel it inside. And I love that invitation because it's really, again, pointing towards how can I find a sense of freedom and openness and even emptiness. There's a quote from Ryoko in the 18th century Zen master who said, I wish that my robes were wide enough to hold all the world. And they are wide enough if there is no self present. I'm paraphrasing a little bit, but the idea, if I can let go of my own story and my narrative and it's all about me and da 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 da, that takes up a lot of room. If I can let that go and rest in the place of open-heartedness, then there's room to hold and be available, to hold, to listen to the cries of the world and not be overwhelmed. Because part of an intrinsic part of faith is also equanimity and a way to be able to stay in balance and steadiness and rootedness in the practice, to be able to hold that which is coming from both within and without. Gil Fronsdale writes about faith, or speaks about faith, as one's partner. It is faith that is one's companion, and wisdom that instructs. The lightning and release is a mortal release from all suffering. This is from the Buddha. It is faith that is one's partner. It is faith that is one's companion, and wisdom that instructs. The lightning and release, a mortal is released from all suffering. But this invitation to also hold faith as a companion through us, that it can sustain us when we do fall into times where it's really hard, to be able to lean back into a sense of faith. Okay, I'm not alone. James Baldwin writes, no one grows up without suffering. Right? Another from James Baldwin, life is tragic simply because the earth turns and the sun inexorably rises and sets. And one day for each of us, the sun will go down for the last time. Perhaps the whole root of our trouble, the human trouble, is that we will sacrifice all the beauty of our lives. We'll imprison ourselves in totems and taboos and crosses and blood sacrifices, steeples, mosques, races, armies, flags, nations, in order to deny the fact of death, the only fact we have. It seems to me that one ought to rejoice in the fact of death, ought to decide indeed to earn one death. By confronting with passion the conundrum of life, one is responsible for life. It is the small beacon in that terrifying darkness from which we come and to which we will return. How do we earn our death? All right. Naomi Neab Shai has an invitation that we live our life like a poem. And I would invite us to live our life as an act of faith, as an act of really trusting that we can move from the ground upon which our heart rests. In Sharon Salzberg's book, Faith, which is beautiful, she shares a story, I think. I'm reading it from a Tricycle Magazine article, but I think it's in the book as well. And this is a story from the text. It's the questions of King Melinda. A group of people gathered on the edge of a flooding stream, and they want to go to the far shore, but they're afraid. They don't know what to do. They don't know how to cross the stream. Until a wise person comes along and assesses the situation, goes back and takes a running leap and jumps to the other side. And seeing the example of that person, the others say, oh, it can be done. And then they also jump. And this is told in a different way. Sometimes it's a wide river and someone swims across, and sometimes it's about cows and mother cows helping their baby cows. But the idea of one person comes along and says, oh, you do this. In the story, the near shore is our usual confused condition, and the far shore is that of the awakened mind. Inspired by witnessing another, we say, oh, it can be done. And this is one level of faith. It's the bright faith. We see someone jump and be like, I want to be able to jump. After we have jumped ourselves, we say, yes, it can be done. And that becomes a whole nother level of faith when we're the one that says, I can do it. Follow me. And when we can really land in our sense of faith, however we might be defining that for ourselves, there's tremendous power and gravitas and strength in that ability to be clear. This is what matters. This is the foundation upon which I want to build my life. I don't know if I brought it. There's a story that the Buddha shares. Not if I brought it. In which the faith is the seed, that it's the beginning of everything, the mindfulness. I won't be able to pull it from memory, but just the idea that it starts with faith. It's the seed that's planted into the soil, and from that our practice can grow. Faith of the many lists in the Buddhist practice, the Buddhist teachings, faith is the first on the list of the spiritual faculties, and I like to think of these as the spiritual superpowers. There's faith, there's effort, attention, mindfulness, and wisdom, and these mighty five are really what we need to sustain us through our practice. But again, the faith being paramount, because again, it's a sense of energy. It allows us to be in the flow. It is the fuel which allows us to get through what can be the heart. Like sometimes our practice is boring, or we don't want to do it, or the struggles with practice, when we can remember, oh, what's actually true? Where am I trying to go? I'm trying to go into a place of understanding, why am I suffering so much, and why am I caught? How can I disentangle myself and step into a life of more freedom and more ease? From Camus. In the midst of hate, I found there was within me an invincible love. In the midst of tears, I found there was within me an invincible smile. In the midst of chaos, I found there was within me an invincible calm. I realized through it all that in the midst of winter, I found there was within me an invincible summer. And that makes me happy. For it says, no matter how hard the world pushes against me, within me there's something stronger, something better, pushing right back. He writes at another time of the abiding hearth of the invisible summer within. Right. So nice. And when we find ourselves in the dark night of the soul, or the times of just bleak winter internally, despite whether it's 85 and sunny outside, to be able to cultivate, touch into, reach into, imagine that abiding hearth of summer that rests within. This is faith. I believe in the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. At least I did before. I believe in the sanctity of marriage and romantic love everlasting, and democracy and in a fair and just society. At least I did before. I believe in the existence of polar bears and honeybees in oceans with more fish than plastic. At least I did before. I'm not sure what to believe now in this era of Twitter rants and Facebook news, alternative facts, and deep fake videos. So I've changed the question. Where can I rest my heart? Where can she find peace and nourishment and inspiration? The will to be emboldened, to befriend the dragons of the past and soar with the ones of the future. I rest my heart upon the movements of music and upon the smile of a stranger, the smell of a summer peach, the yawning, gaping stretch of the Milky Way. I rest my heart upon the cupped hand of another upon my cheek and in the fierce grip of my daughter's hand in mine. I rest my heart in the aspirations, my intentions for goodness and kindness and the balanced repose of equanimity, knowing I will fall short again and again. I rest my heart among the orchestrated movements of the sun and the moon and the oceans and the winds, knowing that countless beautiful and tragic things will happen today and tomorrow. I place my heart upon the wide mantle of patience and wisdom, trusting they will prevail despite the seeming evidence to the contrary. I rest my heart here, for where else would I want her to be? Let's see, hold on. From Rilke. You darkness that I come from, I love you more than all the fires that fence in the world, for the fire makes a circle of light for everyone. And then no one outside learns of you. But the darkness pulls in everything, shapes and fires, animals and myself, how easily it gathers them, people and power. And it makes it possible a great presence is moving near me. I have faith in the nights. How do we learn to live in a way that we can embrace, at least not turn away from, the sorrows and the tragedies and the pain and the suffering? Because it's coming. It's coming anyway. There's nothing that we can do to stop that particular tide. So if we can learn to cultivate a turning towards to say, okay, I might not like it and I might find the experience unpleasant, but we can mine it and dig into it to say, what can I learn and how can I use this to really step into a place of freedom, to be able to move in the world in a way that is congruent with that which really matters and that which is really important to us. As I said, there are three types of faith. There's the bright faith. There's the verifying faith, which is the questioning and really trying it on. And does this fit? And no, I need another one. And does this fit? And how does this work? And developing it over time and the deepening and practicing and questioning and practicing and practicing and taking the practice in different forms. The third developmental phase of faith in this tradition is that of abiding faith. That we just know it in our bones. The one that can say, oh, you jump across the stream or you swim across the river. That's abiding faith, that it just becomes something that if we go back to the O'Donohue quote of wanting to move like the river flows, unknowing, that is the abiding faith, to be able to say, okay, I don't know, but I'm going to enjoy the ride because the other option kind of sucks. To be caught in a place of like, this is terrible, and complaining, and I've been there, and I'm sure many of you have been there too, but when given the choice between looking at how can I use this particular moment to wake up or find compassion or connection, or to kind of dissolve into a puddle of unhappiness, this one feels better. Sometimes this does feel good, I will admit, the sort of wallowing, and I've been there, but long term, not so much. So how can we really start to appreciate that another gift of the faith is it's a connection. It allows us to stay connected to our heart and connected to another. Look, we came here. Right? Like when you think about what brought you here, whether it's habit because you've been coming here since the beginning of time with Spirit Rock, or you came because, well, maybe I'll learn something or maybe I'll see what happens. It's a motion of faith. We get up in the morning, we get out of bed. That too, in a way, can be a step of faith when we hold with it. Is there a way I can make meaning of this day, regardless of what happens? Not being tied to the outcome, right? It's just being able to step in and see what happens. I want to read two things about this idea of faith in action. So this is a quote, a poem from Alison Luderman, Being Alone. I'm never alone. God supplies you in various disguises, scattered through my day like an overlooked miracle. A saint's face in an oil-slick puddle, say. Or the dog who comes up to investigate and lingers for a moment in communion. Or someone stooping to put arms around a crying child. This is to counteract those mornings when to wake is to face broken glass in the mirror. And the least touch shatters everything. When I recall how you'd roll over and say, hello, beautiful, smile and lead me gently back to the bad dream labyrinth, into sunlight, hot, sweet tea, and the next thing to do. Now I muscle through the fog alone on a different, meaner street in an uglier time. There's a man who looks like he's been shot out of a police siren and spent too many nights trying to find his way home. Hank always hangs around in front of Mac's auto detail. A clean car is a well-running car. He lopes, half-bent, as if to straighten fully would hurt. Yet when I walk by with my red hair like a flag from a country called Abandoned Woman and 40 years of disappointment showing on my face, he never fails to gallantly rise to the occasion and say, hello, beautiful. And sometimes, I seen you in your car yesterday. As if he knew I was missing some vital connection, something he could supply in just such small, exact details. God matches our need for each other with our prayers for each other to show us, if we pay attention, how the fabric of our long-lost love can stretch to cover all the world. In this beautiful, if we pay attention, right? That's kind of the whole game. If I pay attention to when I'm caught from some story in the past, or if I pay attention to the beauty of a sunrise or to the smile of my daughter or to the fact that we can all be here on this Monday night, paying attention to be open to the goodness that life has to offer us. That is a form of faith in action. Another piece I want to bring in was from today's Washington Post. It was an op-ed written and co-signed by 149 African-American members of Obama's cabinet, Obama's government. I'll just read a little bit of it. We've heard this before. Go back where you came from, go back to Africa, and now send her back. Brown and black people in America don't hear these chants in a vacuum. For many of us, we've felt their full force being shouted in our face, whispered behind our backs, scrawled across lockers, or hurled at us online. They are part of a pattern in our country designed to denigrate us as well as keep us separate and afraid. There's nothing truly more un-American than calling fellow citizens to leave our country by citing their immigrant roots or ancestry or their unwillingness to sit in quiet obedience while democracy is being undermined. Our love of country lives in our demands and our commitment to use our voices and our energy to build a more perfect union. We ask all Americans to be a good neighbor by demonstrating anti-racist, environmentally friendly, and inclusive behavior towards everyone in your everyday interactions. The statesman Frederick Douglass warned, "The life of a nation is secure only while the nation is honest, truthful, and virtuous." This nation has neither grappled with nor healed from the horrors of its origin. It is time to advance this healing process now through our justice, economic, health, and political systems. Expect to hear more from us. We plan to leave this country better than we found it. This is our home. That's right. So beautiful. And to me, this is such an example of faith, the faith in the dream that is America. So how do we stand up and protect it? How do we protect our own selves, our families, the animals we love, the earth, our country, right? And the call, how do we do it from a place, not from reactivity and anger that just foments what's already happening out there that's so unpleasant, but really to be coming from a place of love, right? What choice do we have? So I'm going to read two more things and then shift gears. So if we remember, I invite you to call back to the meditation, the invitations to think about the earth element and the water element. So this poem, The Clearing, by Martha Postlethwaite. Do not try to save the whole world or do anything grandiose. Instead, create a clearing in the dense forest of your life and wait there patiently until the song that is your life falls into your own cupped hands and you recognize and greet it. Only then will you know how to give yourself to this world so worthy of rescue. So that's the earth element. For the water. Again, another poem from David Wyatt. All the true vows. All the true vows are secret vows. The ones we speak out loud are the ones we break. There is only one life you can call your own, and 1,000 others you can call by any name you want. Hold to the truth you make every day with your own body. Don't turn your face away. Hold to your own truth at the center of the image you were born with. Those who do not understand their destiny will never understand the friends they have made, nor the work they have chosen, nor the one life that waits beyond all the others. By the lake, in the wood, in the shadows, you can whisper that truth to the quiet reflection you see in the water. Whatever you hear from the water, remember. It wants you to carry the sound of its truth on your lips. Remember this place no one can hear you, and out of the silence you can make a promise it would kill you to break. That way you'll find what is real and what is not. I know what I'm saying. Time almost forsook me, and I looked again. Seeing my reflection, I broke a promise and spoke for the first time after all these years in my own voice before it was too late to turn my face again. So I'm going to ask each of you in the room and each of you at home if you'll close your eyes. And to allow yourself to call to mind the image of clearing the dense forest in your mind. And it may be helpful to imagine, to envision just such a place, a clearing in a forest. Maybe a beautiful grassy field surrounded by a dense forest. And to picture yourself in the midst of this grassy field, this clearing. Within the busyness of your own mind, and take just a moment here to feel how it is to stand in the center of the clearing of the dense forest of your mind. And if you feel like, oh, no way, my mind is too busy, imagine what it would feel like if you could stand in the middle of a clearing in the dense forest of your mind, in the clearing the center of your busy life. To see what it would be like to feel into, embrace the spaciousness that would come from such a clearing. Allowing your sense a moment of saying to yourself, there's nowhere else to be, there's nothing else to do. But feel yourself opening to the sense of spaciousness. That is your birthright. And just to take a moment here, just again to breathe in a sense of spaciousness, whether it's felt or imagined. It's helpful to picture a clear, gorgeous blue sky above. Imagine the sense of the blue skies, the blue sky in your mind, the spaciousness that can embody each of your cells. Each breath in, each breath out. fostering the sense of spaciousness and calm. And then if we stay with this metaphor of being near the woods, imagine we walk a bit to the nearby lake or the nearby pond. This lake in the wood and in the shadows. Can you look into this pond, this river, and see the reflection of yourself, your wise self? The self that allows you to feel into the steadiness of the mind, the openness of the heart. Buddha's teaching, it would be touching into your own Buddha nature, the goodness of your heart, the clarity of your mind. When you look into this reflection, what is the secret vow you hear from the water? What is it that deeply matters to you? The line from Rumi, like a fish out of water, hears the call to the ocean, come back, come back. What is it that calls to you? What is it that speaks to you from the reflection of this clear pond in the woods? What is the secret vow you would make? And how you want to live your life, the qualities you might most want to embody, invite in, cultivate, how you might like to greet each day, greet your beloveds and the strangers on the street. How might you want to meet the struggles and the triumphs of your day? I want to invite you to sit a while by the edge of this lake or this pond and to see if you can hear. What that truth is in the quiet reflection that you see in the water. And whatever you hear from the water, remember, it wants you to carry the sound of its truth on your lips. Remember, in this place, no one can hear you. And out of this silence, you can make a promise it would kill you to break. How is it you want to show up in this precious life when there is so much good to be done? So thank you for your kind attention. What I'd love to do, we still have some time, if you're game, is to perhaps turn to your neighbor and to maybe just take a minute or two not to share your secret vow. That would kill you, to mention. But just to touch upon perhaps what, if anything, you discovered that really matters to you or something that came up in this idea of an invitation to what is it that you do rest your heart upon? Full permission to not participate. But I think there is value in saying aloud that which we care about as a way for us to share in the safety of this beautiful space, to name that which really matters, or another way to phrase it is, what is it that you would rest your heart upon? So again, if you're game, I might ask you just to, without any effort, just turn to your neighbor, and the person who's closest to this side of the wall, if that makes sense, could go first. Or you can decide who goes first, and maybe just take a minute or two, I'll ring a bell. The other person take a minute or two, and then we'll have a chance to share as a group, and then we'll close it up. So does anybody have any questions? Does this make sense? Okay. There's really no wrong way to do this. So enjoy the time. And then just invite you to switch at a time that feels right. And I'm going to invite you to thank your partner or partners in whatever way feels appropriate. And then I'd love to, we have a few minutes to open it up if anybody would like to share. I think we have mics. Do we have mics? We have mics. Thank you. So if a few people would like to share, I'd love to hear from you. Please. And if you wouldn't mind just hanging on for the mics and so the folks at home can hear.
Yeah, we were discussing it, and I think it came from the op-ed that you read. And if beyond the obvious things like my family and my children, if there was one thing that I could lay my heart on and feel so good about that, it would be kindness. If we could all be more kind, it's a two-way thing. You get so much from being kind to somebody, and they pass it forward. So I'm thinking kindness.
Beautiful. Indeed. Thank you so much. Yeah, amen. And right here, please. Thank you, microphone master.
Hello, I'm Rob. I wanted to get clarification. When you were talking about prayer, did you say something like we don't do prayer here? Or what did you say related to prayer and, I guess, Spirit Rock?
I think it's from my experience, it's not typically something that is spoken about. And when Joseph was talking about it, he spoken about it in the context of he was teaching at the Harvard Divinity School. Typically, when asked about prayer, he said he would sort of deflect it and be like, well, not so much prayer. But at Harvard Divinity School, he felt like he needed a better answer. And the better answer being like, well, actually, if prayer is really how I, this is me speaking, really as a form of a devotional respect, that we see it all the time as people walk into the hall to bow, that there's profound respect and devotion and beauty here. But just the languaging of prayer is not used that often. I'm not sure if that helps, but that's how I would answer that. Yeah.
It was a good connection for me about what happens here.
Yeah. Yeah, and a lot of it is just the words that we use and sort of one tradition bumping up into another and where things can get to, like sort of the Judeo-Christian version and then what's happening in the Buddhist tradition and the cultural fit. So thank you for your question. Yeah. Yeah, please.
Hello. So I had a discussion this morning about a family who are kind of very conservative, fundamentalist, right-wing, and judgmental. And the question was, you know, how do you deal with it? I mean, it could be your mother. I thought that the distinction you made between belief and faith was important in that belief does sort of suggest that I have one and you have one and they may not be the same. And most likely, because of the social forces and media forces around us, they're, you know, designed to be polar,
yes.
Right?
Yeah.
But inside of faith, we have a commonality of what we surrender to, which could be, in a Christian sense, one thing, or in a Buddhist sense, another. But the nature of that acceptance around both those positions made sense. So it was helpful to me in that discussion, and probably try to turn that around.
Thank you so much for saying that. I also appreciate what you're pointing to, that I think the underpinning of all the religion is kindness. It's love of how do we really treat each other. And then it kind of gets co-opted into these rigid beliefs that wars over centuries have been fought over. But to really allow us to drop into, well, what's actually true? And how do we move from a place of love? So thank you so much. Long day, right? It's 9 o'clock. So I might close with a poem. it's called Good Bones by Maggie Smith. Life is short, though I keep this from my children. Life is short, and I've shortened mine in 1,000 delicious, ill-advised ways. 1,000 deliciously ill-advised ways I'll keep from my children. The world is at least 50% terrible, and that's a conservative estimate, though I keep this from my children. For every bird, there is a stone thrown at a bird. For every loved child, a child broken, bagged, sunk in a lake. Life is short, and the world is at least half terrible. And for every kind stranger, there is one who will break you. though I keep this from my children. I'm trying to sell them the world. Any decent realtor walking you through a real shithole chirps on about good bones. This place could be beautiful, right? You could make this place beautiful. So thank you so much for coming tonight. Enjoy the evening. Please, let's make the world beautiful. Take care.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.